All right, now we are going to transition over to our study into the book of Deuteronomy. We are continuing our study in Deuteronomy chapter 5. I'll be going off the notes. I've got 4 pages of notes. I had 7 last week. I was able to get through them in 1 hour and 5 minutes. I should be able to get through this in much shorter time, unless I start chasing rabbit trails, which, I don't know, I seem to do from time to time, and most of the time it's productive. So I'm going to read through Deuteronomy 5, 22 through 27, and then we'll come back and look at it a little more carefully. And by the way, this follows the giving of the Ten Commandments, which God personally spoke at Mount Sinai. Freaked everybody out, remember? That's what we're going to look at tonight, is their response. So just reading through it, it says, "These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire, of the cloud and of thick gloom, with a great voice, and he added no more. He wrote them on 2 tablets of stone and gave them to me. And when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders. And you said, 'Behold, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness. And we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. And we have seen today that God speaks with man, yet he lives. Now then, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer, then we will die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? Go near and speak. Go near and hear all that the Lord our God says. Then speak to us all that the Lord our God speaks to you, and we will hear and do it.'" So this is Moses recalling. Now remember that the Ten Commandments were spoken roughly 1445 B.C. This would have been about 40 years earlier. This was spoken to the original Exodus generation. Some of whom, Moses' audience here, because this is Deuteronomy, this is the second giving of the law, and in this context here, Moses is restating the Ten Commandments and many of the laws that were given. And he's giving it in sermon form. He's exhorting them, as it were. And so when you're reading this and you're looking at this, what he's doing is he's talking to the second generation of Israelites, many of whom wandered around in the wilderness with their parents, but many of whom were born during the time of the wilderness wanderings, during the 38 years when they wandered around in Kadesh Barnea, until finally that generation died off, as the Lord had said would happen. And so some of these would have remembered this event, and then some would not have. They would have heard about it through their parents. And Moses is here recalling it. But this is a history lesson, as it were. He's hearkening back to the original response that came from those Israelites who were at Mount Sinai. So when he opens up in Deuteronomy 5:22 and he says these words, the Devarim, this would be the Ten Commandments. This would be the ten laws that were spoken directly by God from the mountain. And so remember that they had heard this, that this was a live event. And so, again, had we have been there, that this was objective. Everybody heard this with their own ears. This was God speaking audibly. This wasn't some mystical voice in their head. Okay, it wasn't that sort of thing. And so I commented that had we have been there with our camcorders or our digital recorders, we could have recorded the whole thing in Hebrew as God spoke it to them. And then we could have put it up on YouTube or on some podcast and let everybody listen to it. And so it would have been that kind of event that, you know, would have been audible. So again, these words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick gloom, with a great voice, and he added no more. So speaking from the midst of the fire, so again, some of the second generation of Israelites would have been at Mount Sinai 40 years earlier. They would have remembered that. They would have been younger, under the age of 20, because remember, it was only those who were 20 and older who were held responsible in the wilderness when they kept testing the Lord until finally God said, "I'm done with you. You're going to die off. And your children are going to go in, but you're not. And they're going to suffer for your unfaithfulness." And so they're going to wander around and be shepherds out here in the desert, you know, for 38 years until eventually you pass. But some of them would have remembered this event. So again, it would have been from the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick gloom, with a great voice. And then it says, and he added no more. So he stopped at the Ten Commandments. And so no more direct revelation is going to be given from God. Now, we want to remember that there were, again, 613 commands. And so God continued to speak. He continued to give commands. Only what we have here is we have a request from the people that says, we don't want to hear any more directly from God. It was a little overpowering to them. It was a little overwhelming. Now, I think they should have stayed. I think they should have continued listening to the Lord directly. But they were a little overwhelmed by it. And so what they did was they came to Moses, in effect, and they said, hey, listen, Moses, why don't you go up? You talk with God. We know he's there. He's talking. We've heard him. We've had this great experience. Why don't you go up and talk with him? You get the law and then bring it back to us. So that's what's going to happen. Is the law is going to continue to come from God, but rather than coming immediately or directly, it's going to come mediately through Moses. So Moses is going to be the voice through which God is going to speak. But when you think of the 613 commands, when you think of the whole package, you have to think of it all as being divine in origin. And so when Moses is speaking here, he's simply speaking as the voice of God, as the mouthpiece of God, because this is what the people asked for. But then it tells us here that Moses tells us that he added no more, so he gave no more direct revelation, so rather he revealed the rest of the law through Moses, but he wrote them, that is the Ten Commandments, on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So they heard the commandments, but then there were these hard copies that God made, as it were. And so God makes these two copies. And, you know, many times you think of the Ten Commandments and you think of five on one and five on the other. And that's possible. That's possible. But really, if you go back and you look at some of the suzerain vassal treaties, which is what this is based on, this covenant here, this structure, there's a literary structure to the book of Deuteronomy that is very much in line with the suzerain vassal covenant treaties. And the idea was that two copies were given. One was given by the suzerain, the overlord, and the other by the vassal, the servant. And so these two copies, and where were they kept? Well, they were kept in the temple, which was like the storage room, the safe place, where this contract was kept, that they could refer to it at any time. And we know that both these copies would have been kept where? In the Ark of the Covenant. Because that was the meeting place. That was where the people came to meet the Lord. And it was where the Lord's glory rested, his Shekinah glory. Remember at the tabernacle and then later at the temple, his Shekinah glory was there. So it was the meeting place. So the fact that these copies of the Ten Commandments were put in there was the hard copy, the signed copy, as it were, of the contract arrangement that everybody had agreed to. And so I think the fact that you have two duplicate copies with the Ten Commandments on each one is probably more the picture of what we have here. And by the way, these were written by God himself, because the text tells us he, that is the Lord, wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So not only did they hear the voice of God, but Moses had in his hot little hands these copies, these handwritten copies that were by God given to him. And again, they were stored in the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Covenant. And so Moses was given these two tablets of stone. And then in verse 23, we have the response, the recorded response of what happens with the Israelites. So verse 23, and when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, he says, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders. So that is the leadership. So the leadership came forward, probably urged on by the people, and they were probably glad to come forward anyway. But the heads of the tribes and your elders came forward, and this is what they said. Behold, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire, and we have seen today that God speaks with man, and yet he lives. Now, I'm sure that they probably felt absolutely overwhelmed by this encounter. And there are other examples, and I'll chase a few. Go with me over to Genesis 32. And we looked at these before, but that's all right. You know me. We'll look at them again, just to drive the point. Genesis 32, verse 30. And this is the account with Jacob when he sees the angel of the Lord. The angel of the Lord. And he comments that he has lived. Let's see. Now, this is the account where Jacob is... Remember, Jacob originally fled from Esau. Remember, he took the birthright, and he was sneaky, and he dressed up and put some hairy stuff on his arms and played himself off to get the blessing. And then he fled. He had to flee for his life because Esau wanted to kill him. And he goes up and he stays with his uncle Laban, who was quite the snake. And Jacob, he was his name means chiseler, and right, he heel supplanter. He was a sneaky guy himself, but he met his match with his uncle Laban. But by the time after 20 years of being with Laban, he became the superior over Laban. He mastered his craft, so to speak. And anyway, so he's returning. He's leaving Laban now. He's coming back in the land, and he's met by the Lord. And you have this interesting encounter where in verse 24 it says, then Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, we realize here in a minute that this is the angel of the Lord. This is a theophany. This is an Old Testament appearance of Jesus Christ. It is a theophany. It's an appearance of God in human form. Now, Jacob doesn't know who he's wrestling with here. He's going to know here in a minute. Verse 25, when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. So here they're wrestling together, and the angel of the Lord dislocates the socket in his thigh. Now that would have been a painful experience, right? And by the way, I argue here that Jacob limped away a better man. He was hurt. He was injured by the Lord. And he walked away on a staff. He was in a lot of pain. And I think that this was part of his humbling, that God was working with Jacob to produce in him some humility. But then Jacob, he was pretty tough. He said, and then the angel, the man said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but what? Israel. And he says, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. And that's what Israel means. It means to strive with God or to wrestle with God. Then Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel. For he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been what? Spared. And so he knew. He knew. Now you have other examples of this. You have another one. I'll jump over in Judges chapter 13. Judges chapter 13. And this would have been the parents of Samson. And boy, they had their hands full with him, didn't they? In Judges chapter 13. And you look back here at verse 21. Judges 13:21, it says, now the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah or his wife. And then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And then Manoah said in verse 22, so Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die, for we have seen God. Okay, so Judges 13:22. So this was his assessment. We shall surely die. Now I think that Manoah's response here was irrational. And his wife actually kind of helps him out a little bit here. And I think she's diplomatic about it. But his wife said to him, she says, listen here, hubby, right? So this is Steve's paraphrase. But she says, look, if the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have let us hear these things like this at this time. So he's having this heightened emotional response. He's like, we're going to die. And she's like, wait a minute. Let's think this through. We're not going to die. He's like, it doesn't make sense. You know, that we're going to hear all this and learn all this stuff, and then he's going to kill it. It doesn't play out, right? So she's thinking it through, and good for her. And I think, I'll be honest, I really draw that comparison here with that generation at Mount Sinai. Because I almost put it in the same category, that if they had really thought about it, if God wanted to kill them, they'd be dead, right? And so now they're a little freaked out about it. They're a little spooked, right? And they come to this conclusion like, we don't want to hear anymore. We're going to die, right? So then they're going to propose something to Moses. Now, this isn't altogether wrong because there is humility there, and the Lord's going to recognize that. But they did acknowledge. They said, hey, look, the Lord has spoken to us. We've heard his voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen today that God speaks with man, and yet he lives. Verse 25, now then, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer. Then we will die. Really? I don't know that that's altogether rational. It would have been nice if there was a Mrs. Manoah there to kind of say, hey guys, think about it, right? But nonetheless, behind this is a fear of the Lord, which is a healthy thing. It's a very healthy thing to have. And so, but this is what they're saying to Moses, right? So they're saying, look, if we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer, then we will die. Verse 26, for who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? So this was a new experience for them, and they didn't quite know what to do with it. And they were certainly, there was certainly a healthy fear there. But I think it went a little bit beyond that. I think it got to be a little bit irrational. But here's what they propose to Moses. They come to verse 27. So the proposal is, go near. They're talking to Moses now. They're telling Moses, go near and hear all that the Lord our God says. Then speak to us all that the Lord our God speaks to you, and we will hear and do it. So this is positive volition, right? Now, they're not completely opposed to what the Lord has to say. They're a little bit of an overreaction, but nonetheless, they come up with a proposal, a solution that allows them to kind of step back a little bit and not have this direct encounter with God. I think they're forfeiting something here. I think they're forfeiting a lesson and an experience that I think would have served them well many years into the future. And so they're asking Moses to be in that something. They said, look, you've already been up there. You've had enough. You seem okay. You're not freaked out about by it. So you go ahead and keep on doing your thing. And you just come back and tell us and we'll do it. Whatever you tell us, we'll do it. So there's in the moment a positivity. Now, just like I've mentioned before, and we did this when we went through, remember, Making Sense of the World. And we talked about coming in and preaching to a generation, kind of like Jonah did when he went and preached to the Syrians, right? And you had this turnaround, you had this response. And we talked about how the faith of one generation is what? It's the faith of one generation. And it's no guarantee that subsequent generations are going to respond to that. And so what happens is that you can have people that are positive at one moment and then even within a few months or a few years later go negative. Sometimes it doesn't even have to go to the next generation. And so that's what's going to happen here, because remember that they told Moses originally, they said, look, you come back, you tell us, we'll hear it and we'll do it. But within 2 years, they had tested the Lord, complained, wanted to kill Moses, wanted to go back to Egypt because there was free food in Egypt. It was a buffet there waiting for them. And they could go back and just resume their old life and everything was going to be fine, not thinking. Remember, collective amnesia. Egypt's destroyed. The economy's in ruins. They plundered them of all their gold and silver. There's nothing there. The Egyptians probably don't. If the Egyptians saw them coming over the hill, they'd probably freak out. They'd be thinking, please don't come back. We sent you away. Go away. I mean, our Pharaoh's dead, our army's been destroyed, all of our chariots, they're nothing. I mean, they're left vulnerable in ruins, as it were. And now you come back, no thanks. But within a period of 2 years, they were not obedient. They did not do what they said they would do. And this is where you have to think about it in the context. And so in one sense, there is some truth in the moment, but I think it's short-lived. And you can read the book of Exodus and Numbers in particular to get the rest of the story as to whether or not they were in fact true to their word. So let's take the summary here. So the main point of this pericope is that Moses recalled that God wrote down the Ten Commandments and how the people expressed a healthy fear of the Lord. And Moses opens this section saying, "These are the words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire and of the cloud and of the thick gloom with a great voice." And he added no more. He wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. This confirms that the Ten Commandments were spoken directly by God, who then provided Moses two hard copies, which were written on tablets of stone. Now, the Ten Commandments, as given by God at Mount Sinai to Israel, should not be separated from the larger body of the Mosaic Law. And we must remember that, and here I'm quoting Leviticus 27:34, quote, "These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai," end quote. So again, this was very specific to these people at this particular time in history. And by the way, we want to be able to tie the events of the Bible to historical events. These weren't just things that they just kind of thought up in their head. They were actually tied to history. And to deny the historical veracity of these events is really to call the Bible a liar, is really what it's doing. And this is one of the things about Christianity and about the truth of God's word, is that the things that are set forth here are tied to history. And not only that, but remember that the Ten Commandments and the whole of the Mosaic Law was not only applicable to that original generation that entered into the covenant, but all of their subsequent children down through the generations. We read 2 Kings 17, where we talked about how God sent in the Assyrians to destroy the 10 northern tribes because they violated the terms of the covenant established by their fathers back at Mount Sinai hundreds of years earlier, 700 years earlier, 800 years earlier. And so you look at that and you realize that that historical event was a true event and that there were consequences held for those people who violated the terms of the covenant. Not only that, but you have to realize that language, that there has to be integrity to language, that words that meant something back then mean something today. That you can't be loosey-goosey with the language and start saying, oh, well, it could mean this, it could mean that. In other words, it has to carry meaning throughout the ages in order for people to be held accountable to it, in order for subsequent generations to be held accountable to the words of that contract arrangement. And so you have to be able to tie it to history, and you have to have integrity of language for this to serve as a reliable vehicle down through the ages to which people were held accountable for these commands. Now, Moses is also clear that the Lord did not provide anything more than the Ten Commandments. And here I'm quoting from Deuteronomy, and this is from the Expositor's Bible Commentary. This is Earl Calland. He says, he, quote, added nothing more, end quote. He says he added nothing more refers to these Ten Commandments that were spoken and then written by God on the two stone tablets, and they constitute the basic behavioral code that was to determine not only their allegiance and lifestyle, but also that of succeeding generations as well. No other such short list of commands begins to compare with the effect that these have had in world history. In spite of being constantly broken, they stand as the moral code par excellence. So even though we break the commands, the commandments don't go away. And we're going to do a study here in a little bit on the subject of human conscience, because Paul makes a very insightful statement, a very profound statement in Romans chapter 2 that we're going to unpack here in a little bit to show the continued impact. Now, going on in the notes here, Moses records the response of the Israelites, saying, "And when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders," end quote. Now, every one of the Israelites at Mount Sinai heard the voice of God audibly, which came from the direction of the mountain that was burning with fire. So apparently the audio was quite loud, and it was connected with pyrotechnic effects. I couldn't think of a better word. I may have to choose a different word next time around. But that was the word that came to mind, was these pyrotechnic effects. So there was this the fire, the smoke. And so it was quite visual. So they were seeing it. They were hearing it. And I suspect that the volume was such that, you know, there was, again, probably close to 2 million people here listening to this. And, you know, you get that volume cranked up and your body can begin to vibrate, you know, as a result of the sound. And I'm sure it was quite impactful. I'm sure it was quite powerful. So after approaching Moses, the elder said, quote, "Behold, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness. And we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. And we have seen today that God speaks with man, yet he lives," end quote. So here was a divine encounter with the God of the universe that was so powerful that they were surprised that they were still alive. Then they spoke out of fear, which wasn't altogether wrong. We're going to see that here in the next section. But they spoke out of fear, saying, quote, "Now then, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer, then we will die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived?" End quote. Now, being close to God meant, to some degree, feeling uncomfortable in his presence. Because as they came near to him, they became painfully aware that he is holy and they were sinful. Now, I was careful when I crafted that sentence. And it's one of those sentences that I worked on several times trying to get just the idea and just set forth just so. Because, and you see this in the Bible, that when people have that direct encounter, they feel uncomfortable. Especially when they're seeing God in his holiness. It's almost like they just don't know what to say. Now, when Jesus came, his glory was veiled. Remember that in his humanity. And so, and then you have that encounter up on the Mount of Transfiguration. Remember when they go up there and Peter, James, and John, you know, the three who were closest among to the Lord among the disciples, and they go with him up on the Mount of Transfiguration, and the glory of the Lord shines through. His glory is, his body becomes almost luminescent, as it were, and begins to shine through him. And then there's the voice from heaven that says, "This is my beloved Son." But Peter, he's caught off guard. He's like, what do we do here? "Oh, I know. Let's make some tabernacles. One for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." And the voice comes out of heaven and says, "Listen to my son," right? And so it's almost like, "Stop talking, Peter. Okay, this isn't for you. Listen to what he has to say." And so it's almost like Peter just kind of shuts down a little bit, you know, because you don't know what to do in those moments. You're caught off guard. You're like, all of a sudden, here's Jesus that you've seen clothed in glory, and you just see him as a man. You see his miracles. Right? You see his power over nature, you know, calming the storm. You see his power over demons, driving them out. You see his power over sickness, healing. You see his power over death, raising the dead. I mean, you see his power through his miracles, through his life, through his words. And then all of a sudden his glory shines forth and he's like, whoa. Okay. And so I think when people have that encounter with God where they actually come into the presence of his glory, and they see that, I think it makes them feel uncomfortable. And that's what happened with Isaiah, remember, in Isaiah 6. When Isaiah goes into the temple and the Lord shows up, right? And the Lord shows up there with all of his glory. And so Isaiah is like, whoa, it's me. I'm undone. I'm a man of unclean lips. Maybe he had a potty mouth, right? And he says, I'm undone. I dwell amongst a people of unclean lips. But the grace of God sends an angel, goes forth and takes a coal and touches his lips and says, you're cleansed. Well, it's grace. Right? That's mercy. I mean, how wonderful is our God? But again, it's that thing where when somebody comes into that presence of the glory of God, there is an uncomfortableness. And I think that's normal. I think that's healthy. And just like when John on the island of Patmos, when he sees the risen Lord in all of his glory, and the description is quite magnificent, the way John describes it. And then John says, I fell at his feet. It was like a dead man. And I think he may have fainted. I don't know. But he had a response that he hit the ground, you know, and that was appropriate. And so I think that coming that close to God meant to some degree feeling uncomfortable. So this is not altogether an unnatural or unwholesome response that they have here. And so they came near and they became painfully aware that he is holy and they were sinful. However, they felt that their lives were in danger if they continued to experience God's presence as he had revealed himself at the mountain. And so as I was just talking about, healthy fear was a common experience among those who personally encountered God, and others too felt their lives had been spared after encountering the Lord. So though the Israelites recognized it was God who spoke with them, and that they'd heard his voice and saw his glory, yet they did not want the experience to continue. And I think if we're going to want to draw near to God as believers, we have to learn to be okay with feeling that sense of uncomfortableness, for lack of a better way of put it. Because you have to be willing to say, okay, you know, it puts me in an awkward spot because here you're holy and I'm so aware now of my sinfulness and, you know, I feel so out of place and unworthy. But see, that's humility. Humility is not a sense of worthlessness, it's a sense of unworthiness. Because you don't deserve the Lord of the universe. You don't deserve his love. You don't deserve his kindness. You don't deserve his mercy. And that's what makes it so magnificent, is that he gives it because of who he is and not because of who we are. And so, you know, so having this sense of fear is can be very healthy. And so going back to the notes here, so though the Israelites recognized it was God who spoke with them and that they'd heard his voice and saw his glory, yet they did not want the experience to continue. Instead, they asked Moses to serve as mediator between them and God. And this is what they asked him, saying, quote, "Go near and hear all that the Lord our God says, then speak to us all that the Lord our God speaks to you, and we will hear it and do it." And so the Lord is going to honor this as we look in the next section, as we jump in this next hour here in a little bit. The Lord is going to honor this. And he's basically going to tell Moses, he's going to say, okay, I will accept their request. And their request is good for the moment. But then he's going to say something else. And I'll wait until we get to that to address that. See, baited you, didn't I? Caught you. Left you hanging, right? It's good marketing. Just kidding. So the last paragraph here for us. As Christians, the more we learn about God, the more we become aware of his holiness and our sinfulness. However, by faith, and I'm careful with that too, it's not by feelings. By faith, we also know that he accepts us because of the work of Christ. And that we can come humbly before his throne of grace. And that's what Hebrews calls it, isn't it? In Hebrews 4. It calls it a throne of grace. Realizing that there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. But see, the blood of Christ has opened the way for us to come before our Father. And look, when I sin, and I do, and I come before him, and I own it, I say, Father, you know, can't hide it. I confess it. Your word says if I confess it, you're faithful and just to forgive it. I trust you at your word. And if there's consequences, I'll bear that. That's part of what it means to grow up and be mature, is that you have to be willing to own your life and whatever consequences of choices you make, you're willing to own that. But you come to the Lord. But just like I mentioned before, that when it comes to restoring fellowship with God, when I sin, I know three things are true. I know three things are true. I know first and foremost that when I sin, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. I know that I am not in danger of losing my salvation. Okay? And I know that first in my mind. Now, the second thing I know is that because I've sinned, I am now out of fellowship with God. And being out of fellowship with God puts me in a dangerous spot because it means that I'm not under the control of the indwelling Holy Spirit. It means I'm under the control of my old sin nature. And I'm operating according to the worldly values around me. And at that moment, I am not a friend of God. I'm a friend of the world. Okay? And I know if I continue in that, If I don't address that pretty quickly, if I don't confess that sin pretty quickly and get back into fellowship, if I decide to perpetuate status quo carnality, well, guess what? He whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. And so I know that even though I'm not condemned, if I stay in that spot and perpetuate that, I know that I'm opening myself up to a divine spanking. Okay. And the third thing I know to be true is that if I confess that sin, he's faithful and just to forgive it. And by the way, that was hard for me to learn, I think, the first year or so, because I kept feeling this sense of guilt. And I kept feeling like, well, you, how do I really know? And it just came down to where I just quit beating myself up over it. And it said, your word says it. I believe it. And that settles it. And how I feel is inconsequential. Now, there may be consequences. You know, it's just like if a parent tells a child, don't touch the stove. I know the fire's pretty. Don't touch the stove. I know it's pretty. Don't touch the stove. You turn your back for a second. Wow! And the kid disobeyed you, right? They reached out and they touched the stove. And then they say, I'm sorry, Mommy. Do you forgive them? Of course you do. But are there consequences for their actions? Sure. The relationship is restored. You forgive them, right? And they're certainly not in danger of ceasing to be your child. I mean, that's just crazy, right? But even though the relationship is restored and you say, you know, I'm glad you're humbly, you know, coming to me with this, you know, confessing it. Yes, I forgive you. I wish you had obeyed me. And the commands are not designed to withhold from us some good. They're actually designed to protect us from harm. And so when God gives us the laws and the commands, it's designed to protect us from harm. And when we make those choices, even though we're restored to fellowship, there may be lingering consequences for that sinful action. And so that's something else that carries on there as well. But I know that I come before his throne of grace. All right, so I'm going to do a brief excursus here. We are going to chase an intentional rabbit trail because I was thinking about the law, and we were talking about it last week when we did the introduction to the Mosaic Law, and we talked about the whole of the law and how you have to take it as a package and how we are not under the law. We're not under the Mosaic Law. We're under the royal law. We're under the law of Christ. Galatians 6:2 makes very clear, because the Mosaic Law has been rendered obsolete. Some of the commands that were under the law were restated in the New Testament, but the general rule is what has not been restated has been abrogated, has been done away with. And so just like 9 of the 10 commandments were restated, the one commandment that was not restated was the Sabbath. And I believe the reason it was not restated was because the Sabbath was the sign of the Mosaic Covenant. And to keep the Sabbath is to recognize that that is still in effect. That covenant is still in effect. And that's not what Hebrews 8:13 tells us. It tells us that that covenant has been rendered obsolete. In fact, we are under a different covenant. We are under the what? New covenant. And we have a sign that goes with that covenant. It's not the Sabbath. It's what we did tonight. It's the Lord's Supper. And so that's the sign of the new covenant for us. Because all of us relate to God by way of a covenant somehow or another. It's how he relates to us and how we relate to him.